it's time to read the Des Moines Register for Tuesday, March 12th. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Teresa Whitaker, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Sally Ortigas.
Ortiz.
For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Today, the forecast is warm with clouds and sun. Winds south to southwest from 7 to 14 miles per hour. Patchy clouds tonight. Winds northeast 4 to 8 miles per hour. They're expecting a high today of 70 and our low of 44. Tomorrow, the expected high is 69, partly sunny and warm, and a low of 51. Sunrise today was at 7:31 a.m. Sunset tonight will be at 7:18 p.m. Moonrise today, 8:44 a.m., and moonset today at 10:37 p.m. Our extremes for yesterday was 78 at Estherville, and our extreme low was 28 at Muscatine. So our headlines today, Tyson to permanently shutter Perry plant, roaming cattle cause car accidents, ruin crops, Northeast Iowa neighbors say, and 51% oppose outside audits of agencies. So now here's our first article with Sally.
Tyson to permanently shutter Perry plant. Arkansas-based Tyson Foods says it's permanently closing its Perry pork packing plant, a move that will leave the 1,276 workers at the city's largest employer without jobs. After careful consideration, we have made the difficult decision to permanently close our Perry, Iowa pork facility, a company spokesman said in an email Monday. Tyson said it will encourage employees to apply for other positions within the company. Tyson said it still employs 9,000 people in Iowa, and it has pork facilities in Waterloo, Storm Lake, and Columbus Junction. It's the second big blow this year to Perry, a town of about 7,930 residents that already was struggling with the January school shooting that left three dead and injured six others. It's our economic base, said Mayor Dirk Cavanaugh, adding that it's unlikely that any other plants Perry workers could move to would be close enough for them to remain in the community. While not all Tyson workers live in Perry, they still buy groceries, gas, and other services there, Cavanaugh said. It's a large percentage of our community, he said, adding that he plans to work with local, state, and company leaders to find a new employer to use the plant space. United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 1149, represents between 700 and 800 of the plant's employees. We feel that Tyson owes that community, Perry, and the employees some kind of compensation, some kind of training, some kind of benefit for a lot of those families, said the union's president, Roger Kale. We're definitely going to be asking for some kind of compensation for these people. We're going to try and get as much as we can get for these people because they deserve it. He said the union would help as many people as it can to find other jobs, but that the openings in other packing plants are starting to tighten up. Workers coming off shift left the Tyson plant Monday afternoon holding their lunch bags and walking with their heads down. They told us in a meeting they were closing down the business, Jamie Morales, a worker who has been with the company for more than 3 years, told the Register in Spanish. Talks about the plant closing had been spreading among workers, but there wasn't an official announcement from the company until Monday, Morales said. There's nothing you really can do besides look for another job, he said. The move comes after the pork industry has encountered staggering losses over the past year. I'm disappointed but not surprised, given the grim economic conditions pork producers are struggling with, said Pat McGonigal, CEO of the Iowa Pork Producers Association. The Perry facility slaughtered and processed about 9,000 hogs each day, and Iowa producers who sold to that plant now will need to seek out others. Typically, the cost of that transition has been borne by producers, McGonigal said. The economic times in our industry are very difficult right now. Last year was the worst financial downturn in a quarter century for Iowa and U.S. pork producers, with rising costs outstripping prices farmers received for their livestock, experts have said. Pork producer losses averaged $32 per hog last year, Lee Schultz, an Iowa State University economist, said last month. Losses are forecast to shrink to $18 per head this year, he said. This year, McGonigal said, adding that he hopes no other Iowa pork plants close. Tyson has been experiencing headwinds since last year when it closed chicken processing plants in Jacksonville, Florida, Columbia, South Carolina, Van Buren and North Little Rock, Arkansas, Glen Allen, Virginia, Corydon, Indiana, and Dexter and Noel, Missouri. Tyson said it understands the impact of this decision on our team members and the Perry community. We are also working closely with state and local officials to provide additional resources to those who are impacted, the company said. While this decision was not easy, it emphasizes our focus to optimize the efficiency of our operations to best serve our customers. In 2018, Tyson won $674,000 in state incentives as it made a $44 million upgrade to the plant. The Iowa Economic Development Authority said Monday no incentives ultimately were released for the project. Kavanaugh said he had hoped the expansion would help keep the plant operating in Perry. He said the community has been in a similar spot before, experiencing ups and downs with the industry for decades. After a meatpacking plant closed in Perry in the mid-1950s, the Iowa Pork Company organized to build a new plant on the now Tyson site in 1962. And it quickly became Perry's largest employer, according to a history by Perry Economic Development. Staff writers Kevin Baskins and Jose Mendiola contributed to this article.
In our next article, roaming cattle cause car accidents, ruin crops, Northeast Iowa neighbors say. Aggressive bulls bringing chaos to Howard County. And this is by Donnell Eller. In a corner of far northeastern Iowa, cow chaos reigns. There have been wrecked vehicles, damaged crops, hundreds of calls to the sheriff's office. Somebody is going to get killed before it's all said and done, Mike Friedhoff says of the situation he and fellow residents have endured for years. They're lobbying Howard County officials to force a farmer to corral cattle they say are terrorizing their neighborhood, charging people, devouring and trampling crops, and roaming the roads at all hours. Last month, an Elma woman driving home about 8:40 at night plowed into a massive bull. The 63-year-old driver didn't see the black animal on the dark road in time to stop, according to the sheriff's office report on the accident. Her SUV was totaled, the report said. Luckily, she escaped without serious injuries, neighbors said. A sheriff's deputy shot and killed the injured bull, owned by Michael F. Hastings, who lives 5 miles east of Elma, a town of about 500 that's roughly 60 miles north of Waterloo-Cedar Falls. The Des Moines Register was unsuccessful in its efforts to reach Hastings for comment on his neighbor's complaints or the accident, which occurred about a mile from his home. About a year ago, Howard County supervisors hired a company to erect a fence around part of Hastings' property on Key Avenue, a $63,765 expense that officials are charging to Hastings' property taxes. But a fence on two sides of a four-sided property has done little to keep Hastings' roughly 30 cattle from wandering, neighbors say. Their frustration is mounting. Some have killed cattle that strayed onto their land, concerned about their family's safety, said James Franson, who lives about a mile from Hastings. The cattle, many of which are bulls, walk through fences that are in disrepair, he said, and they're aggressive. It's a public safety issue, said Franson, recounting how loose cattle have charged his truck as he drives to work. You can't walk on Key Avenue, he said. We should have a safe environment to live in. Howard County Sheriff Tim Beckman said in an email his office has received numerous complaints about Hastings' loose cattle. Beckman declined to say more, pending possible county litigation. Howard County Attorney Kevin Scoberl also declined to comment. Joe Pisney, chairman of the Howard County Board of Supervisors, said the sheriff's office is called to the area two or three times a month. A 2020 application for a search warrant to check on the health of Hastings cattle said the sheriff's office had been called to the area 150 times over 9 years, including 9 times that September alone. A deputy wrote in the warrant request that he thought the cattle were breaching the fences due to the lack of food given the pasture's shorn grass. A judge granted the warrant, enabling then-sheriff Mike Miner to take a veterinarian to examine the cattle. The cattle did not meet the neglect standard, Pisney said. Neighbors say that Hastings has hay bales occasionally delivered to his farm. We can't just take his cattle, Pisney said, adding that Hastings has rights as well. Franson and Chad Buckley, whose father lives and farms south of Hastings, said they too believe the cattle are looking for food and water. The cattle drink from a creek that runs through Hastings property, but it freezes during the winter, Buckley said, and it can run dry during drought, which has been at extreme levels in Howard County since last August. Franson and Buckley said Hastings brings buckets of water to the cattle, and Hastings has told officials the cattle get water by eating snow and ice during the winter. That's not sufficient for animals that large, Buckley said. An average cow will drink at least 10 gallons of water a day. You can't tell me he's pouring 300-plus gallons into little buckets to try and meet the requirements for these animals. Pisney said he shares many of the concerns that Hastings neighbors have. Last month, the supervisors asked Scoberl to investigate ways to force Hastings to maintain fencing to contain his cattle. But that will take time, Pisney said. We're hamstrung. Franson and Buckley say Iowa's fence law fails to address the difficulties the neighbors face. The 1815 law is too vague when it comes to regulations for containing livestock, Franson said. State laws just aren't helping us. While Scoberl declined to comment, it appears the county used the state's law addressing trespass by stray animals to build the partial fencing around part of Hastings' property. Iowans on whose land livestock trespasses 3 times or more within a year may ask the owner to erect or maintain fencing. If no action is taken within a month, neighbors can turn to local officials. We call it 3 strikes and you're out, said Christine Tigran, director of the Iowa State University Agricultural Law Center. The law acknowledges that sometimes livestock can find a way through fencing. Every once in a while, you'll have a bull that's a Houdini, Tigran said. But there's a duty of care not to put others at risk, she said. Livestock owners may need to make hard decisions if the animals can't be contained. The law asks, what would a careful and prudent farmer do, Tigran said. Brian Waddingham, executive director of the Coalition to Support Iowa's Farmers, said repeated instances of roaming cows are rare. Cattle are worth a lot of money, and you want to do everything you can to keep them safe and protected, said Waddingham, whose group works with farmers and community members to address concerns about livestock operations. This is a situation I don't normally run across. Franson said his neighbors would gladly help Hastings round up cattle if it happened occasionally, but it's a daily occurrence, he said. The cattle are so wild, there's no such thing as chasing them back, he said, adding that neighbors have tried talking to Hastings about the problem over several years. Pisney said the trustees of the township where Hastings lives turned to the county supervisors to pay for the upfront fence costs. An adjacent landowner to Hastings also is sharing the cost for a small east-west fence the county had built. We've put in as much fencing as we legally can, Pisney said. We'd love to fix the problem overnight, but we just can't. State law requires that the owner of straying livestock pay for damages their animals cause. Scoberl, the county attorney, represented an Oklahoma man in 2020 who also ran into one of Hastings' cows. The truck driver sued Hastings for medical costs, lost wages, and other damages. About a year later, Scoberl's client dropped the suit. Vicki Cartwright, the driver who hit Hastings' bull last month, couldn't be reached for comment. Buckley said Hastings' cattle ate and trampled about $20,000 of his father's corn and soybeans in 2022. When you see the cattle in the spring and summer, they've got juicy growing crops in their neighbor's fields, so they look pretty healthy, he said. He and his father put up an electric fence at the corner of a field that Hastings' cattle routinely enter, but it's done little to stop the animals. Buckley said it just takes them a little longer to get into the field. Buckley said the family is considering seeking damages in small claims court, but he's unsure whether they would recover any money. Last month, Iowa's Department of Revenue won the right to garnish payments from a Chickasaw County farmer who rents Hastings farmland. The state seeks about $18,000 for 3 years of back taxes from Hastings. It's not just neighbors and motorists who have run into difficulty. Buckley said a Howard County Sheriff's deputy was called to a nearby hog confinement about a year ago where a bull was threatening workers. The deputy had to shoot the animal, which neighbors said was attracted to feed at the facility. Neighbors walk a fine line if they shoot Hastings livestock, said Jennifer Swaggerman, Drake University's Agricultural Law Center Executive Director. If you truly fear there's danger to yourself or others, then you have a right to protect yourself, Swaggerman said. Residents shouldn't shoot the animals because they're concerned about property damage, though, she said. Being loose is generally not enough, she said. Franson said neighbors won't let their children or grandchildren play outside because of the loose cattle, which can weigh up to 1,500 pounds. Friedhoff put up an electric fence to keep Hastings' cattle from his yard. He won't approach the cattle on foot, instead using a small tractor to chase them away from his property. They'll chase after you. They can be mean, said Friedhoff, who once picked up 20 pails worth of manure from his yard before erecting the fence. Neighbors who have destroyed the animals report it to the sheriff and have them removed. It's a crazy situation, but we're trying to play by the rules, said Buckley, who's concerned the cattle could cause more accidents or hurt residents. Everything is moving in the wrong direction.
Iowa Poll, a Register exclusive since 1943. 51% oppose outside audits of agencies. GOP seeks outsourcing. Dems defend auditor. Written by Galen Bachauer. A majority of Iowans oppose a Republican-led bill that would allow state agencies to outsource their annual audits to private CPAs, circumventing the state auditor, a position held by a Democrat, a new Des Moines Register Mediacom Iowa poll finds. 51% oppose the proposal, compared with 43% who are in favor. 7% are not sure. Senate File 2311 would allow Iowa's state agencies to hire a nonpartisan certified CPA for their annual audit in lieu of the state auditor's office. It passed the Senate in February on a party-line vote and has not yet been considered in the House. The bill comes a year after Republicans passed a law curbing the investigatory powers of state auditor Rob Sand, Iowa's only statewide elected Democrat. Sand and legislative Democrats have called the new bill a political ploy to kneecap the auditor's authority, while its Republican supporters say it's a good government bill that would better suit a short-staffed auditing field. Iowans' opinions on the proposal vary along partisan lines. Among Republicans, 49% are in favor, with 42% opposed. More Democrats dislike the bill, with 24% in favor and 72% opposed. Independents are closely split, with 47% in favor and 49% opposed. Iowans' thoughts on the bill also vary depending on how they evaluate Sand's performance as auditor. Those who approve of Sand's job performance skew against the bill, allowing private sector audits, with 37% in favor and 62% opposed. A majority, 55%, of those who would disapprove of Sand's performance support the bill, with 41% opposing it. Those who are not sure of Sand's performance lean towards supporting the proposal, with 48% in favor and 36% opposed. The Iowa poll, conducted by Seltzer & Company, surveyed 804 Iowans from February 25th through the 28th. It has a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Totals may not add up to 100% due to rounding. Rebecca Morris, a 54-year-old poll respondent from Burlington who agreed to a follow-up interview, said she opposed the proposal. If we're going to go to the private sector for these audits, then what are we paying a state auditor for? Said Morris, a self-identified Republican. If the state auditor can't do his job, then why are we paying him? She also expressed concerns about the transparency of outside audits and the private firms conducting them. If they're going to the private sector, who's auditing them? She asked. Eric Case, a 50-year-old from Mechanicsville who also identifies as a Republican, said he thought outside auditors could bring accountability. I'm all for decentralization, he said. The bill's sponsor, Senator Mike Bousillot, Republican, Ankeny, has called it an attempt to create public innovation and foster good government. Only in politics can the hiring of an independent, nonpartisan, certified public accountant be accused of being political, said Bousillot, who also led passage of the 2023 law curbing subpoena powers. Bousillot has said the auditor's office and firms across Iowa have struggled to recruit and hire certified CPAs. The bill, he argues, would address a short-staffed field while granting state agencies the same option as local governments in pursuing a private audit. Democrats have panned the bill as an attempt to diminish the standing of SAND. Senator Tony Bisignano, Democrat, Des Moines, called it paranoia. This isn't the first attempt to try and diminish the state auditor, Bisignano said. This is a cheaper attempt, in my opinion. Sands said he believed the bill intends to undermine an independently elected official of the state of Iowa and for all the people who work in this office for taxpayers. About the Iowa poll, the Iowa poll conducted February 25th through 28th, 2024 for the Des Moines Register and MediaCom by Seltzer & Company of Des Moines is based on telephone interviews with 804 Iowans ages 18 or older, interviews with Quantel Research contacted households with randomly selected landline and cell phone numbers supplied by Dynata. Interviews were administered in English. Responses were adjusted by age, sex, and congressional district to reflect the general population based on recent American Community Survey estimates. Questions based on the sample of 804 Iowa adults have a maximum margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. This means that if this survey were repeated using the same questions and the same methodology 19 times out of 20, the findings would not vary from the true population value by more than plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Results based on smaller samples of respondents, such as by gender or age, have a larger margin of error. Republishing the copyright Iowa poll without credit and on digital platform links to originating content on the Des Moines Register and MediaCom is prohibited.
Okay, and the headline in our Metro and Iowa section, Muscatine sues ex-lawyer, claims conflict. Attorney was suspended after admitting sharing confidential information with ousted city official. This is by William Morris. An attorney already sanctioned by the Iowa Supreme Court for undermining the city he was working for now is on the receiving end of a legal action by his former client. Matthew Brick of the Brick Gentry Law Firm in West Des Moines admitted in filings before the Supreme Court that while representing the city of Muscatine, he shared confidential information with the city's then-administrator, Greg Manziger, about Manziger's impending firing and advised him how to lay the groundwork for a future lawsuit against the mayor and council. The Supreme Court found Brick, who specializes in legal representation of cities, including Muscatine and Newton, had violated multiple ethical rules over the course of almost a year by providing advice against his client's interest. It suspended his law license for 30 days. Brick served that suspension in August of 2023. Muscatine fired Manziger in 2019, and he sued the city, its mayor, and council in 2021. His complaint included claims for disability discrimination, retaliation, wrongful discharge, and conspiracy. The case is scheduled for trial in July, but on February 26th, the city filed its own petition in the case, not against Manziger, but against Brick. In its filing, the city cites the Supreme Court disciplinary case and alleges that Brick assisted in engineering or causing this lawsuit by Manziger. In particular, the city says Brick admitted that after a council member during a meeting requested an agenda item to terminate Manziger, and Manziger shortly after texted him that he was considering seeking leave under the Family and Medical Leave Act, he encouraged Mansinger to do so. Mansinger's subsequent lawsuit accuses the city of discrimination for terminating him while on that leave. At one point, Brick texted Mansinger during a city council debate on Mansinger's termination, writing, "Hold on, I'm busy trying to save your job." Brick subsequently sought to sabotage the city's legal position by preparing a termination letter for Mansinger he intentionally wrote to be legally insufficient, the city says. In their petition, the city and the city officials sued by Mansinger accused Brick of negligence and breach of fiduciary duty. They also argue that, to the extent the court finds any liability by the city toward Mansinger, Brick should be on the hook for some or all of those damages. The new petition is only the latest in a chain of litigation stretching back to 2017, when Muscatine City Council impeached then-Mayor Diane Broderson. A district court later found Broderson had been improperly. Singer then sued Broderson for defamation, and she responded with her own defamation claims against both Mansinger and Brick. These claims were all voluntarily dismissed prior to trial. Brick, whom Muscatine has since replaced as city attorney, did not respond to a message seeking comment and does not yet have an attorney listed to represent him. An attorney representing the city in its petition against Brick also did not respond to a message from the Des Moines Register.
Drake Nursing Program provides degrees in 1 year, designed to get staffers into workforce as demand grows. A new program set to launch at Drake University in the fall will allow students to gain a nursing degree in just 1 year. The program is designed to get nurses into the workforce quicker as demand for healthcare workers across the U.S. grows. There are two paths for students to choose, according to a news release from Drake. In the first, students who have fulfilled prerequisite classes will be able to enter an accelerated 1-year program and receive 2 degrees, a Bachelor of Science in Health Science and a Bachelor of Science in Nursing. The second path allows students to complete an interdisciplinary curriculum of prerequisites that combines coursework in the biomedical, pharmaceutical, and clinical sciences before advancing to the accelerated Bachelor of Science in Nursing program. This program is going to have over 600 hours of clinical lab and simulation time, and we have a partnership with Broadlands Medical Center, said Mary Owens, director of the nursing program. We won't only go to Broadlands for clinicals, but Broadlands is providing a clinical nurse educator to work with our faculty to provide the program. Owens said the university also has partnerships with Mary Greeley Medical Center in Ames and Wesley Life Senior Living Communities in Des Moines. Students that are studying clinical medical sciences here at Drake will meet all of the prerequisites for the nursing program, Owens said. So the advantage of that is that they can walk away with 2 degrees in 1 year. They can have a degree in clinical medical sciences and then also a Bachelor of Science in Nursing. Owens said the program comes in response to rising workforce needs. She added, there is a desire from students to pursue nursing, but some institutions have limited capacity. That capacity has led to an inability to match industry needs. So an accelerated program could help bridge the gap, she said. A report on Iowa's nursing demand in 2022 found nearly 60% of healthcare facilities statewide reported a shortage of qualified applicants for open nursing jobs. Of those, about 19% reported an extreme shortage, and roughly 36% reported a great shortage. Iowa's healthcare and social assistance sector was down 7,200 workers in November 2022 compared with February 2020 before the pandemic. As of March 3rd, there were 3,208 job postings for registered nurses and 689 for nursing assistants on the Iowa Workforce Development job site. As long as students have met their prerequisites, they can come to this 3-semester, 51-credit program and do their nursing courses. It's full-time, Monday through Friday, but they'll be able to do that in any year, Owens said.
Revenge porn sentence is eased. Man doesn't have to register as sex offender. It's an article by William Morris. A Boone County man who posted an explicit video of an ex-girlfriend online does not need to register as a sex offender, the Iowa Supreme Court says. Friday's decision came in the case of Caden Miller, who, according to court filings, recorded a sexual encounter with his then-romantic partner. After the relationship ended on bad terms, he uploaded the video to a pornographic website and showed the resulting post to at least one person. Miller subsequently pleaded guilty to first-degree harassment under Iowa's 2017 law banning so-called revenge porn, admitting in his guilty plea that my intent was to get back at her for our relationship ending on bad terms by annoying her with the video being public. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison. The district judge in Miller's case also ordered that he register as a sex offender after finding, as required by law, that his offense was sexually motivated. The judge ruled that posting the video to a pornographic website and showing it to a friend demonstrate his ongoing interest in sharing his sexual interest in the video. In a 6-1 decision, the Supreme Court reversed that finding. The state needed to prove, beyond reasonable doubt, that Miller's motivation for publicizing the video was sexual rather than, as Miller admitted, annoying his ex. Justice Christopher McDonald, writing for the majority, found prosecutors hadn't. McDonald noted in particular testimony from a psychologist who tested Miller and found no signs of sexual deviancy, but a lack of self-esteem that contributes to embarrassment and anger when his interpersonal relationships fail. After he found several of the district court's arguments, including tying the act of posting the video to Miller's sexual motivation for the original sex act, not reasonable or supported by the record. To judge Miller's actions inherently sexual would mean any act of revenge porn is inherently sexually motivated, McDonald wrote. While there are crimes that Iowa law automatically treats as sexually motivated, violating the revenge porn statute is not one of them. Were we to conclude this record was sufficient to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this crime was sexually motivated, we would transform this crime of harassment into a per se sex offense, McDonald wrote. That we cannot do. Chief Justice pushes back. If this is not the sort of case the legislature intended, I do not know what set of facts is. The sole dissent came from Chief Justice Susan Christensen, who wrote that, in her view, categorizing the non-consensual posting of sexually explicit material to a pornographic website as a sex offense is likely appropriate. Christensen drew from research highlighting the psychological impact of revenge porn incidents on victims, and argued the legislative history of the revenge porn law showed legislators envisioned adult offenders being required to register as sex offenders. If this is not the sort of case that the legislature intended to result in the perpetrator's registration as a sex offender, then I do not know what set of facts is, she wrote. The Supreme Court declined to consider several other issues Miller raised on appeal, but vacated the finding Miller was sexually motivated and the registration requirement. Miller's attorney, Lucas Taylor, said the court reached the right decision. We applaud the court's application of the law, which requires a nuanced approach when deciding sex offender registry placement, and reject the notion that using a pornographic website implies sexual deviancy, he said in an email.
New pickleball courts coming to Altoona Park, an article by Chris Higgins. Some new pickleball courts are coming to Altoona later this year. The city is planning for construction of 4 new pickleball courts at Ironwood Park on Altoona's south side off the intersection of 3rd Avenue Southwest and 24th Street Southwest. Construction is expected to happen in the spring, so the new courts are ready for the summer. The courts will be just north of the newer parking lot on the south side of the park. The $189,000 project will include installing the courts, fencing, and new sidewalks leading to the courts, and benches. Pickleball was the fastest growing sport in the nation for the 5th consecutive year in a row in 2023, according to the Association of Pickleball Professionals. It said 48.3 million U.S. adults had played at least one game in the last 12 months. There are more than 50 places to play pickleball in the Des Moines Metro and at least three in Altoona, according to Pickleheads, a website dedicated to the sport. Other recreational amenities coming to Altoona this year include a pocket park and mural in Old Town, a splash pad at Haynes Park, and a kayak launch at Spring Creek Park. In other news, man dead, teenager hurt in city's first fatal crash of 2024. Written by Jose Mendiola. Des Moines police are investigating the city's first traffic-related fatality of 2024 after a 30-year-old man died from injuries in a crash on Sunday night. Des Moines police officers and firefighters were dispatched to the intersection of Indianola Avenue and Pine Avenue to investigate a report of a crash at 10:48 p.m., the police department said in a news release. First responders found two people injured at the scene of a single vehicle crash, the news release said. The driver of the vehicle was a West Des Moines resident who was transported to a hospital in critical condition and later died from his injuries, authorities said. The passenger, a 13-year-old girl from Des Moines, was transported to a hospital with minor injuries. Investigators believe the driver was traveling west on Pine Avenue at a high rate of speed, attempted to make a turn, and crashed into a utility pole where the car rolled, according to the news release. Authorities are still investigating the crash.
I have two short articles here by Jose Mendiola. I-80 exit ramp will be closed for 4 months starting in March. The Interstate 80 ramp to Van Meter will be closed for several months starting this spring. Exit 113 eastbound will close at 8 p.m. March 18th and remain closed until about July 1st, according to the Iowa Department of Transportation. Crews will be doing grading and pavement work. Travelers can follow a marked detour by traveling eastbound on Interstate 80 to the next exit at Dallas County Road, R-22, which is exit 117, and then travel west on Interstate 80 to exit at Dallas County Road R-16, which is exit 113. And three teenagers hospitalized after Des Moines shooting. Des Moines police are investigating a shooting that sent three teenagers to the hospital on Sunday night. Des Moines Police Department officials were dispatched to the 500 block of Franklin Avenue around 8 p.m., spokesperson Sergeant Paul Parizic said Monday morning. Three teenagers, two 18-year-olds and one 15-year-old, suffered injuries as of Monday morning, were in stable condition, Parizic said. All three of the teenagers were in a car when they were shot, Parizic said. Investigators found shell casings at the scene. The victims of the shooting did not cooperate with police, Parizic said. Investigators do not believe the shooting was random. The investigation is ongoing, and police don't believe there's a danger to the public.
In national news, Trump asks to postpone New York trial on hush money by Bart Janssen. Former President Donald Trump has asked to postpone his New York hush money criminal trial by pointing to his presidential immunity claim under consideration at the Supreme Court. Trump argues he is shielded because he was president at the time some of his actions took place. But legal experts said it would be difficult to argue that paying hush money to women was part of Trump's official duties as president to qualify for immunity. At the federal level, Trump has argued Supreme Court precedents protect him from criminal charges. Without immunity from criminal prosecution based on official acts, the president's political opponents will seek to influence and control his or her decisions via de facto extortion or blackmail, with the threat, explicit or implicit, of indictment by a future hostile administration for acts that do not warrant any such prosecution, his lawyers wrote. Federal prosecutors and judges in district court and the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals have ruled that Trump can be charged. For the purpose of this criminal case, former President Trump has become Citizen Trump with all of the defenses of any other criminal defendant, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled regarding Trump's federal election case. Any executive immunity that may have protected him while he served as president no longer protects him against this prosecution. The Supreme Court will hear arguments on the question April 25th, but the New York trial is scheduled to begin March 25th. Trump has pleaded not guilty to 34 counts of falsifying business records in New York. Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg argued that the former president falsified the records to hide hush money payments before the 2016 election to Stormy Daniels, a pornographic actress, and Karen McDougal, a former Playboy model, to stop them from talking about allegations he had sex with them. Trump contends because the issue is unique, no former president has ever faced criminal charges before, that New York Judge Juan Merchan should postpone his case at least until the Supreme Court rules to avoid potentially having to hold the trial twice. The adjournment would also avoid the unnecessary risk of inconsistent adjudications as to the defenses asserted by President Trump in state and federal courts relating to the presidential immunity doctrine, Trump lawyers Todd Blanche and Susan Nachelis wrote in their filing. The adjournment would mitigate the risk that an error in the application of this complex federal law issue could require the court, the parties, the state, the city, and the county to expend the resources necessary to retry the case. But legal experts said Trump already dropped his argument that the New York case involves official acts when he decided not to appeal a rejection of moving his case from state to federal court. U.S. District Judge Alvin Hellerstein ruled that Trump's alleged conduct in the New York case does not reflect in any way the color of the president's official duties.
Trump-Biden close to clinching races. Tuesday votes could give both enough delegates. This is by Steve Peoples out of New York. President Joe Biden and his likely Republican challenger, Donald Trump, are on track to win enough delegates this week to become their party's presumptive nominees, ushering in a bruising 8-month campaign for the White House. Elections in 4 states on Tuesday will likely give Biden and Trump the delegates they need to clinch the nominations. Their trajectories are hardly in doubt after dominant performances in last week's Super Tuesday contests forced the last major primary challengers out of the race. But for many voters who aren't attuned to the daily twists and turns of the nation's turbulent politics, this week could be a crystallizing moment, reinforcing that another Biden-Trump campaign is virtually guaranteed whether Americans want it or not. And that rematch, the first in a U.S. presidential election since 1956, is poised to deepen searing political and cultural divides. Here's what we're watching. Tuesday should be a wake-up call for those who still doubt that Trump, who is facing 91 felony counts in 4 criminal cases, will represent the Republican Party in the general election this fall. The former president is on track to win enough delegates to become the Republican Party's presumptive presidential nominee if he continues to dominate the way he has throughout the primary season. And with no major opposition on the ballot, there is every reason to believe he will. As of Sunday, Trump was 140 delegates short of the 1,215 needed to win the Republican nomination at the party's national convention this summer. There are 161 Republican delegates at stake on Tuesday in Georgia, Mississippi, Washington State, and Hawaii. With a strong showing Tuesday, Trump can sweep all the delegates in Georgia, Mississippi, and Washington State. Hawaii allocates delegates proportionally, so other candidates could win a few, even with a small share of the vote. Democrats, who did not want Biden to run again, are about to be disappointed. Like Trump, Biden is on the verge of securing sufficient delegates to become the Democratic Party's presumptive presidential nominee. The president enters Tuesday 102 delegates short of the 1,968 needed to win the Democratic nomination. There are 254 Democratic delegates at stake Tuesday in Georgia, Mississippi, and Washington State. In addition to party-run contests for the Northern Mariana Islands and Democrats abroad that conclude that day. With no major opponents, Biden is on pace to reach that mark. But he's also facing continued resistance from his party's left flank that threatens to tarnish the achievement. A collection of progressive activists and faith leaders in Georgia and other states is encouraging Democratic primary participants not to vote for any presidential candidate. That's after a protest, uncommitted vote in Michigan recently secured 2 delegates. The symbolic protest is meant as a warning on Biden's re-election over his support for Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. While Biden's campaign says it's not worried, the president must unite his party behind him if he hopes to defeat Trump in November. Following a fiery State of the Union that he says fueled $10 million in donations in just 24 hours, Biden has an opportunity to build new momentum with a strong showing Tuesday. Georgia has emerged as one of the nation's premier swing states in recent years, and both candidates are eager to put up a strong showing and flex their organizational muscle in what is effectively a dress rehearsal for November's far more consequential general election. The state was a pivotal battleground in 2020, so close that Trump finds himself indicted there over his push to find 11,780 votes and overturn Biden's victory. Both candidates made Georgia a priority in the days leading up to Tuesday's primary, but they offered very different messages in dueling rallies over the weekend. Trump's Saturday rally opened with a message asking attendees to support the people serving jail time for their roles in the January 6th Capitol insurrection. The former president then appeared with MAGA firebrand Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Republican of Georgia, whom he called brave for yelling at Biden during his State of the Union address. Trump also highlighted his private meeting the night before with Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, who has rolled back democracy in his country. Biden, working to energize his coalition of voters of color, young people, and suburbanites, pointed to Trump's controversial associates and his embrace of the far right. "Our freedoms are literally on the ballot this November," he said. With both candidates poised to clinch their nominations, we are about to move formally from the primary to the general election phase of the 2024 election. But it's fair to say we don't know exactly what that will look like. Typically at this moment, candidates will shift their message to speak to a broader swath of voters, especially moderates and independents, who play a more influential role in general elections compared to the hardcore base voters who decide primaries. But if this weekend was any indication, Trump is showing little interest or ability to embrace a more moderate tone. He's still falsely insisting that the 2020 election was stolen and praising those who stormed the Capitol. We'll be paying close attention to the tone of his response and his social media posts after he clinches the nomination. On the Democratic side, we're about to learn whether Biden's coalition changes its view as the reality sets in that this election is now a binary choice between Biden and Trump. Biden's campaign is bidding big that that's the case.
Ramadan begins. Israel warns Hamas. Efforts to send more aid to Palestinians progress. The holy month of Ramadan prompted fasting and worship by Muslims around the world Monday, but it brought no end to the death and destruction wrought by the war in the Gaza Strip, despite intense effort by the U.S. and other nations to broker a ceasefire. Palestinians prayed amid rubble and fear after talks stalled over Israel's resolve to crush Hamas and the militant group's demands for a pathway to permanent peace and the withdrawal of all Israeli troops from Gaza. Israel has vowed to expand its offensive to the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where more than 1 million Palestinians have sought refuge since the war began October 7th, with a deadly Hamas-led rampage into Israel. Hamas has called for stepped-up resistance, drawing a warning from Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. "I say to everyone who is thinking of trying us this month, we are ready. Don't make mistakes," he said. President Joe Biden issued a statement acknowledging that the sacred month has arrived at a moment of immense pain in the enclave as the death toll surpasses 31,000 while almost 2 million remain displaced. He said the U.S. will continue leading the effort to increase humanitarian aid while working nonstop to broker a peace agreement. As Muslims gather around the world over the coming days and weeks to break their fast, the suffering of the Palestinian people will be front of mind for many, Biden said. "It is front of mind for me." Majoub Zewri, a professor at Qatar University, told Al Jazeera the U.S. pressured Israel not to tighten access restrictions at East Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque, Islam's third holiest, in the West Bank. If the Israelis do not listen to the Americans, West Bank is likely to become another Gaza in a matter of months, Zwiri warned. Israel announced last week it would not reduce the number of worshipers allowed to pray at the site for at least a week while monitoring security. The mosque is part of Temple Mount, the holiest place in Judaism, where two biblical temples once stood. Jordan Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi warned Monday that any restrictions imposed by Israel on Muslim worshippers' access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound during Ramadan could result in an explosion. Video posted on social media Sunday night appeared to show Israeli border police clashing with worshippers. Israeli officials are hinting their forces have killed some of Hamas's top leaders, including two among the highest ranks. Israeli media are reporting officials are trying to confirm whether Hamas's number three in Gaza, Marwan Issa, deputy military commander of the military wing, was killed in a weekend airstrike in central Gaza. Gallant seemed to suggest that when he said Monday, "There have been successes, including in recent days, and there will be more successes. The operations are persistent and headed in the right direction." Also Monday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel had killed Hamas's number four without naming him. It appeared to be an acknowledgement of the assassination of Saleh Arouri, the deputy political head of Hamas and a founder of the group's military wing, who was killed in an explosion in Beirut in January. Israel had not claimed responsibility for that attack. 3, 2, and 1 are on the way. They are all dead men, Netanyahu said. We will reach them all. Netanyahu on Monday defended his plan to expand Israel's military offensive into Rafah over the objection of Biden and other world leaders, saying he doesn't want to leave a quarter of the Hamas terror army in place. Netanyahu spoke on Fox News Channel's Fox and Friends, said Biden agrees Hamas must be destroyed. Unless Hamas is defeated completely, the militant group will regroup, regain control of Gaza, and repeat the October 7th rampage that killed almost 1,200 people and saw about 250 hostages seized, Netanyahu said. Biden wants to ensure the safe departure of more than 1 million Palestinians who have sought refuge in Rafah before we go in. We agree with that, Netanyahu said. Look, it's either Israel or Hamas. There is no middle way, Netanyahu said. We can't leave a quarter of the Hamas terror army in place. They're there in Rafah. This would be equivalent to saying, you know, after the Allies fought back, gone through Normandy, went through Germany, and you'd say, well, we'll leave a quarter of the Nazi army in place, and we won't go into Berlin, the last stronghold. The U.S., France, Jordan, Egypt, and Belgium conducted a total of 7 airdrops of humanitarian assistance into Gaza on Monday, Reuters reported, including more than 27,000 meals and nearly 26,000 bottles of water by American forces into the devastated northern part of the territory. The Gaza Health Ministry said at least 25 people, mostly children, have died from malnutrition and dehydration in northern Gaza. Iran Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani dismissed U.S. efforts to airdrop aid as merely symbolic and part of the U.S. attempt to justify providing Israel with weapons being used in Gaza. An explosion took place near a ship in the Red Sea on Monday, but the ship's master said no one was hurt. The British military's United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operations Center said. The attack likely came from the Yemen-based Houthi rebels who have been targeting ships claiming support for Palestinians in Gaza. The private security firm Ambry says the incident may have involved a missile, but few details were available, and the Houthis issued no immediate statement.
Senator pleads not guilty to new conspiracy counts. This is by Katie Sobko. Senator Bob Menendez, his wife, and two New Jersey businessmen entered not guilty pleas Monday as they appeared in a Manhattan courtroom for the third superseding indictment related to federal corruption charges. The state's senior senator, his wife, Nadine Arslanian Menendez, Wall Hanna, and Fred Dibas, now face 18 counts, up from 4, brought by federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York. They include conspiracy to obstruct justice and obstruction of justice amid allegations that Menendez was working to benefit Qatar in addition to Egypt. Once again, not guilty, Your Honor, Menendez responded to Judge Sidney H. Stein at a 20-minute hearing. Menendez pleaded not guilty to the previous charges in October. Menendez and his wife entered the pleas to the indictment containing new charges of conspiracy to obstruct justice and obstruction of justice. The pair has called for the trial date to be pushed back and for evidence, including the now infamous gold bars, to be dismissed. The court has ruled against them. Since the initial indictment was released last September, Menendez has taken aim at prosecutors, alleging the timing of the indictment is part of a plan by the government to keep the sensational story in the press. Menendez is up for re-election this fall. U.S. Representative Andy Kim and New Jersey First Lady Tammy Murphy are in the midst of a contentious Democratic primary battle for the seat. The primary will be held June 4th, likely around the time of closing arguments, if the trial date stands. However, reports surfaced recently that Menendez may not stand for re-election. The most recent version of the indictment alleges that Menendez received payments, including cash and gold bars, from Davis, a developer. In return, he helped Davis get investment from a Qatari investment company connected to that country's government, by doing things that were viewed as favorable to Qatar's government. In June of 2021, Menendez allegedly introduced Davis to a member of the Qatari royal family and the principal of the investment firm, who then negotiated a multi-million dollar investment in one of Davis's New Jersey real estate properties. Menendez would allegedly give statements supporting the Qatari government to Davis before they were released publicly so he could share them with the Qatari investor and a Qatari government official associated with the investment firm, the indictment says. The senator was first indicted in this case last fall. He faces corruption charges for allegedly accepting hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes from Davis, Hanna, and businessman Jose Uribe in exchange for in helping them enrich themselves and trying to get them out of legal troubles. The original indictment included Uribe, who has agreed to cooperate with authorities and changed his plea from not guilty to guilty on 7 counts, including conspiracy to commit bribery and wire fraud. Uribe is scheduled to be sentenced June 14th.
Iowa's Joni Ernst will seek new GOP leadership post in U.S. Senate. Iowa's U.S. Senator Joni Ernst will run to take on the number 3 position in Republican Senate leadership next Congress, her office has confirmed to the Des Moines Register. Politico reported Monday that Ernst, who is the Republican Policy Committee Chair and the 4th-ranking GOP leader, would run to become the Senate Republican Conference Chair. It comes amid a larger leadership shakeup as Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican from Kentucky, is set to step down from his position later this year. Ernst will run against U.S. Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, who previously announced he would seek the post. Ernst's office declined to comment for the Register. She told Politico she wants to be part of a new era within her party. Republicans want to see someone that doesn't just get told how to vote, but someone that can be an independent thinker and provide a voice to reason and to truth, she said, adding, "I'm ready to take that on."